Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gerald Harris, Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your host for this evening. We welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce today's program and speaker. Ian Mitroth is Professor Emeritus from USC, where he was the Harold Quinton Distinguished Professor of Business Policy in the Marshall School of Business and in Annenberg School of Communication. He is currently a senior investigator in the Center of Catastrophic Risk Management at UC Berkeley. He is a fellow of the American Psychological Association, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the American Academy of Management. He has a BS in Engineering and Physics, an MS in Structural Engineering, and a PhD in Industrial Engineering and Philosophy of Social Systems, all from UC Berkeley. Go Bears. He has published over 37 books, hundreds of articles and op-eds. He is a regular blogger for the Huffington Post. He lives in Oakland, California, where he is president of Mitroth Crisis Management. He is generally regarded as one of the principal founders in the field of crisis management. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Ian Mitroth.
Thank you, Cheryl. Let me start by offering a small prayer. Lord, while I walk through the valley of technology, please refrain from throwing tomatoes to the end of my talk. Thank you. Let me get to the heart of my talk. C.P. Snow, the distinguished British writer and scientist, said it best of all, "Technology is a queer thing. It brings you great gifts with one hand and stabs you in the back with the other." We are a technology science which has brought us innumerable gifts, but now it poses one of the greatest threats to humankind. Technology is more pervasive and invasive than ever before. We have to do a better job at managing technology, and that means bringing to bear all we know about crisis management. And hopefully companies will do this themselves, or I'm afraid there's a backlash brewing against technology. For example, there is no good reason why prior to the invention of Facebook, that Facebook couldn't assemble teams of parents, children, psychologists, and I know unquestionably they would have come up with cyberbullying, because if you read the history of technology, there's never been a technology with all positive effects. There are always negative effects. And not only do we have to do better rigorous audits of technology, all the impacts, but do everything we can to mitigate the negative effects. Let me give you some examples, otherwise this gets too abstract. Recently, MIT engineers have invented gold leaf tattoos placed directly on our skins that will allow us to communicate seamlessly with all our marvelous gadgets, which we've not only invented but are reinventing us. Look, we've not only disrupted the sleep patterns of kids bad enough with cell phones under their ears all night lest they miss an important text and email, but now our skins will literally be buzzing all the time. Let me give you another example. Sherry Turkle, who's a clinical psychologist at MIT, has done innumerable studies of Facebook and texting, what it's done to kids. Not only has it disrupted sleep patterns, but Facebook has left kids more disconnected from one another, more isolated and preoccupied, obsessed with perfecting their Facebook page. It's also disrupted the art of communication. Fewer kids know how to begin a conversation that isn't scripted, because there are no algorithms for starting, holding, and ending a conversation. And what she's really worried about is what this does to kids. For example, recently there was an experiment done with young kids. Listen to this. Young kids were taken to a camp for 5 days, where the kids who went to a camp put all their devices aside, didn't use their cell phones or anything. At the end of 5 days, brought out of the camp and compared with kids who were on their devices for 5 days, they were both shown a series of photographs. The kids who went to the camp and put their devices aside were better at identifying social emotions in photographs than the kids who did. if this is only 5 days, what does a lifetime of this thing do? Let me give you another example, maybe humorous, but there's something called BinCam. BinCam is a little camera placed in front of your garbage can or just under the lid that keeps track of how good a recycler you are. At the end of a week, all your recycling habits are fed up to your Facebook account, which is then judged by a team of people. And if you've done a good job, you get green leaves and you have it. Nowhere did the inventors ever think about the ethics of what they're doing. And that's generally true of technology. We can't continue to unleash and dump this stuff on society and then later clean up the effects. The power of a few technology companies is enormous. And against this is the unorganized power of parents and teachers. And if we don't level the playing field, we have an early warning system from the UK where they're seriously considering legislation to protect kids from what's being unleashed and dumped in. I don't like that any more than anybody else. But unless Silicon Valley cleans up its act, that's going to happen. Now, let me talk about more weightier apps, pun intended. There are apps which turn obesity into a game. That's not fun, because if that data are released to insurance companies, employers, God knows how it will be used again, privacy concerns. Elon Musk has recently proposed that the electrodes be planted in our brains, our heads, so that we could better upload our thought and compete with artificial intelligence and better drive our cars. Really, Elon, and what this will do to us becoming cyborgs, which is eventually what we're going to be. A couple of weeks ago, there was a segment on 60 Minutes which featured a guy who gave up trying to beat his head. He was an ex-Google employee. He left voluntarily. And the reason why he left is he just got so frustrated that Google was explicitly designing apps that would hook kids, would feed into their addictive behavior, because all this stuff is so addictive. I'm addicted to my cell phone as much as anybody. But he couldn't take it. He said, you can't keep doing this to kids. And what happens in Silicon Valley is that a lot of the developers that won't allow their kids to use this stuff, but they'll dump it on the rest of the kids out there. Can't do it. What I want to talk about, a few minutes in closing, then take time for your questions and comments, is the following. That what I've been able to do is to call out what I call the technological mindset. It's initially been called, or before it's been called, technological utopianism. And what I've done is read a whole slew of books on technology, pro and con. And from that, I've been able to call out a mindset, which is as extreme as anything, but it's the mindset beneath technology that is really driving it. And it's this technology, this mindset, which really keeps a lot of companies from being proactive. Because if you're really proactive, unlike Facebook, you know, with releasing videos of somebody being killed or fake news, you're doing everything you can to get a handle on this before it's too late to do it. And I contend that you can do it. Let me divert a little bit and give you an example how you can do it. I ran one of the first centers at USC for crisis management. We had corporate sponsors that not only gave us the money to do our research, but more importantly, they gave us access through their company so we could learn what they were doing to head off crises. One of the years, I went out in the field, and I went out to a number of big pharma companies, and I was interested in what they were doing to curb product tampering. So I go out to this one company, and I say, what are you doing to curb product tampering? And without missing a beat, the guy I was interviewing said, we have an internal assassin team. I said, you have a what? He said, yeah, one day we held up one of our bottles and we looked at the cap as the front door to a house and the walls of the house. How could the burglar get in, do as much damage, remain undetected for as long as possible and get out? And we soon learned there's no way to keep the burglar out. But we came up with tamper evidence seal. The point is, when humans are creative, and they can be creative, not that they're perfect. That's not open to us mere mortals. They can come up with very creative, inventive ways to look at their products in a different way. Not as all a bundle of just positive things, but what are the negative things that can also... We don't do enough looking at the negative impact. But anyway, get back to the technological mindset. The first tenet of the technological mindset is technology is the solution to all our problems, including the problems caused by technology. Second thing, technology is the single most important problem factor for material economic progress. It's certainly a factor, and one denies that, but you don't have technology without a science, a society to nourish it. There's no such thing as technology without society, but it leaves that out of the equation. Technology mindset only focuses on the beneficial aspects of technology. Must be protected at all costs with few constraints as possible, therefore no government regulation. I'm sorry, that's not possible. Government comes in to protect us when we can't do the job ourselves. Technological progress is inevitable. I agree with that. It's futile and dangerous to resist, not resist, but to manage it better, to do ethical management of technology. Positive attributes are technology to ruminate on the negatives. Well, I'm sorry, somebody has to think about the negatives. And if you don't, it must be made mandatory. A duty of humans to adapt to technology, why must we always be the ones to adapt to technology? Why not technology adapting to us? The ideology should not be unduly concerned with those who are displaced by tech. They need to be willing to learn new skills. No, I think technologists need to pay into funds. What are we going to do with all the millions of people who are displaced by driverless cars? Because it's not just enough to give people money. Work is a sense of purpose and meaning and self-esteem. And you can't just give people nothing to do. Utilitarian is the prevailing ethic. Issues of efficiency, not justice and human dignity, are prevalent in the technological mindset. If the benefits exceed the cost, then a technology is ethically warranted. So not an ethic of justice. Quantification is to be used in all cases, preferred to qualification. It's highly contradictory because all of these are qualitative statements. The technology mindset doesn't realize. Qualification comes before all quantification. Capitalism, superior economic system, yeah, of course, because the money to be made is incredible. Increased use of robots is not only inevitable, but eminently desirable. The sooner robots replace us all, the better, really. We need to sit around and watch robots. Not only inevitable, but highly desirable. Only deep-seated, long-standing, irrational human prejudice that refuses to grant to machines and robots the same qualities that reserve for humans. That's incredible. I'm sorry, I'm not going to delegate human feeling to a robot. The fact that we're already cyborgs, sorry about that, having problems with the technology here, but we have most of it. We get bit by technology. The ultimate hope is we live long enough to buy medical technology, advance to the point, be the last generation to die, therefore we can sit around and watch robots to the end of time. Okay, those are my formal remarks, but let me end on a note of hope, because that's important. I do know of a company, I won't give the name, and I know somebody who's just been hired, who is a specialist in human development, and this company develops techie toys for kids. And they wanted to hire somebody with a background in child development so that they develop the right toys in the right way that will not harm kids. That is what more and more companies need to do. The second thing that is also a hope, when I go back to my alma mater, because my wife Donna, who's in the audience, we've set up a scholarship at Berkeley to get some technology student to look at the human impacts of technology. There are more and more freshman engineering students that I have met that are interested in this kind of stuff. They're interested in the ethics of technology. They don't see the divorce. They see it's integral. The trouble is we don't have as many professors that would talk about the ethics of technology, but hopefully that will change. So in the end, yes, I'm optimistic. We're a technological society. It's not going to go away. That's crazy or whatever. But we can't leave the management. We can't continue to dump this stuff out and then later clean up its effects. By the time we do that, it's often too late. Again, I go back to Facebook. Let me stop there because we have plenty of time for questions, and now you can throw tomatoes and lob hard questions at me, that I do take a hard stance, that I do believe it needs to be made mandatory, that we do rigorous crisis audits before we unleash technology and have ongoing crisis audits so that we can get at this stuff before it's too late to do anything. We can't just look at the positive effects and that's all that's going to happen, because that's never the effect of technology. It just doesn't come in. One of the things that we've done, all of the qualities that we once reserved for this thing called G-O-D, we've now transferred to technology. It's perfect goodness, perfect intelligence, it's immortal and all the rest of that. Well, I'm sorry, that's not what we should be doing. It's one of the most important things that our civilization has done. It's to be nourished and not to be diminished, but it's got to be managed more carefully. With that, let me stop, and hopefully we can enter into conversation. You can expand on this, or you can challenge me. Okay, let's do it, Gerald. Let me go over here.
Well, thank you for a great start. And I want to thank all of you who are here who are not in, out in Golden Gate Park participating in
the pot fest.
pot thing there. What I want to do is set this up a little bit, and I want to admit a couple of things. One is that I have briefly met Ian before many years ago when I was at a firm called Global Business Network that specialized in scenario planning. And so I spent about 15 years there as a futurist, and I'm going to draw on some of that in the questions that I'm going to ask him. But I met a lot of good people there, and I may quote a few of those as I'm here. The first thing I want to do, though, Ian, is give you a little bit of support. Some of you probably subscribe to the New Yorker magazine. And the New Yorker magazine did an article and I brought it with me, the January 30th issue, which proceeded to explain how people in Silicon Valley were so concerned about things running amok that they were now what's called survivalist. And they were spending millions of dollars buying jets, islands, motorcycles, all manner of things to protect them from what they perceived might be the coming apocalypse. Now, this is in Silicon Valley. So what I want to do is, if I can find the correct quote here, this is from a fellow who was the one of the founders of Facebook. And he says that if we are so concerned, I'm paraphrasing here, about the future, when is the last time you made a donation to a homeless agency? This is what he challenged people in the Valley to respond to. So as opposed to figuring out how to survive by having a private jet or a private island, his solution was one that argued toward compassion. So what I want to ask you is, as we think about the future of how all this is going to unfold, can you give us an idea of what you think the role of compassion may be toward others?
Well, you know, you remind me of one of my favorite columnists that they'll read daily is Tom Friedman in the New York Times. And one of his op-eds recently really sounded the theme. And the theme was he talked about stempathy. He talked about combining STEM skills, science, technology, engineering, math, with empathy. Because if I go back to Sherry Turkle, the follow-on book that she wrote, Beyond, the book she wrote was Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology Than from One Another. The book she wrote was Reclaiming Conversation. And here's what she found. If you go into elementary schools and you talk to elementary school teachers, they're noticing a deficit that kids come to school with not as much empathy as they used to, and whether you blame it on all these devices or one thing, but it's certainly a factor. And so Tom Friedman has said that he hopes that the jobs of the future, which the education of the future ought to be preparing, is combine STEM skills with empathy skills. Now, I was fortunate when I went to Berkeley, all my formal degrees are in engineering. When I was getting my PhD in industrial engineering, and I switched to industrial because I couldn't put it off any longer. I was interested in people and organization. I took a 3.5-year minor in philosophy science. It was really philosophy of social system, and a big part of it was ethics. And the philosophy of science I studied was heavily interdisciplinary, if not transdisciplinary. So we studied psychoanalysis and a whole gamut of things. And when I've lectured to freshman students at Berkeley, and what I've talked about the jobs of the future, and I said, really, none of the things I practice, like crisis management, was in existence when I went to school. I also did work in spirituality at work. Therefore, what do you need to know to prepare for the jobs of the future? And I would say it's some STEM coupled with some deep study of the humanities, preferably philosophy, but history, because that gives you the breadth of education and something that adds to empathy. Now, my wife and I, for years, we have done workshops around the Myers-Briggs where we get people to learn about their personality type and how they see reality differently. And a big part of that is emotional IQ. So we're talking about the cognitive IQ, well necessary. It's not enough. And that's what I'm really, that's my critique of technology. The technology part is good enough. Let me put it even bolder, which you may or may not agree with, but here's what I'm saying in no uncertain way. Zuckerberg and the like, the technologists, are bright and smart enough to invent technology. But they're not, in my terms, have the requisite skills to manage it, to manage an organization, because that calls for a different set of skills to look for whether it's Uber and how you manage people, treat them with respect and dignity. And that's what we're talking about. You need a technical background because we're in a techie society. It's not going away. Anybody thinks it is out of touch with reality. And I'm certainly not talking about, but I'm talking about the better management and integration. So I want technologists from the get-go, when they come in as a freshman, to not only take classes in technology, but classes in philosophy, something that's integrative. Now, I've been fortunate enough, because of the scholarship we set up, to have informal lunches with a lot of techie kids. And the kids are marvelous. They're giving just an example. When I started as a freshman in engineering so many moons ago that I won't mention it, at an incoming freshman class of 200, how many were women? 2. And you can imagine what was said about the sexuality of those young women. And even then, as a young kid, I knew something was wrong. Now, if you go to the Berklee College of Engineering, depending on the class, 30-40% are women. And they do make a difference. I'm not talking about sexes and gender, but they make a difference in the kind of consciousness that is brought to technology. In effect, I mean, look, the money in Silicon Valley is so great, and you have a little boy culture. I know that. The money is obscene. And you couple that with a little boy culture, and you get what you get. And where are the adults in the room? And the adults in the room blend cognitive and emotional IQ. I've gone on a bit. But
great. No, it's a very, very, very good start. So let me give you another thing to chew on, and I'm using big words. So that one is also going to compassion. So here's a word I'm going to throw out at you, and this word is regulation. And let me set this up a little bit. I spent about the first 15 years of my career at Pacific Gas and Electric Company. And if you go back in the history of the electric power business, which in its earlier heyday was viewed as the same wonderful, everything is going to be great. In fact, for I think almost 30 years straight, when you built a new power plant, the cost of the next plant was cheaper than the previous one. So therefore, you had this incredible economic engine of the more you produce, the cheaper it got, and you had to figure out a way to give it to everybody, right? But fast forward, a lot of things happened there. One is a lot of big financial people came in and tried to build giant monopolies. The other thing is it became clear that once it spread out, it became a necessity, not something that's provided to a customer. Let me make it blunt. You cannot allow old ladies to freeze in the dark because they can't pay their electric bill. Okay? Pacific Gas and Electric and all public utilities now have all kinds of regulations in place to deal with exactly these kinds of issues. So the question I want to throw back to you is, are there any thoughts, models, ideas that we can begin to move to some kind of regulatory regime? And I know there's all these industries are different, but any thoughts just on entering that space?
See, I wish I were an expert on regulatory affairs. I'm not. I do know people at CPC that the center in Berkeley were in conversation with them. But let me take a different tack. One of my best friends was the head of the U.S. Census Bureau, and I worked as a consultant in the Census Bureau. And the Census Bureau is one of the best government organizations imaginable. My friend Vince Barraba went on to be head of marketing at Xerox, Kodak, and finally General Motors, the most important marketing job in the world. Now, if you believe that GM is less bureaucratic than any governmental organization, I got news for you. And we need is sensible regulations. But a book that I would recommend that all of you should read is something called American Amnesia, written by a political scientist. And one of the points he makes, to boil it down, America is great because how government worked to aid business. And there's no such thing as society without rules and regulate. Now, sensible rules, they need to be revisited. But we don't have that kind of conversation. It's all bad. For me, government is not the enemy. Having worked both as a consultant to government and to private business, because I don't see necessarily one is better. It depends on the organization. Depends on the leader. When you have somebody like a Vince Barraba, who was a Republican appointee, a Nixon appointee, who went into the Census Bureau with a great clout. He was not welcome. But they soon saw that he was a very good manager. He didn't want to stay in Washington forever. And he was really good at managing people. And he then went back to the public sector. But he was so good, he was called back by a Democratic president because he was such a good manager. And that's what the kind of conversation. We're in the realm of big government. We're not going to get rid of that any more than big organizations. It's time to say what kind of effective organizations we need. And there are some that are effective. And the ones that are effective are back to what we're talking about. Cognitive skills with emotional skills. Treating people with dignity. Doesn't mean that you don't reprimand people if they're not doing the job. Doesn't mean that. Doesn't mean it's a free-for-all. Because the leader of an organization, not somebody who likes to win a popularity con. On the other hand, not to be hated, not with a low approval rating, because you got to manage people. Anyway, that's the best I can give you. I'm not an expert. But one thing I do know, again, I will say it, is Silicon Valley is bringing it on itself. Now, one of the things that happens in a crisis that everybody needs to understand is this. Here's one of the things that a crisis causes. One of the things that, crisis causes death, you lose money, like VW, you got a PR crisis or Facebook, whatever it is. But here's what a crisis does, why it's so traumatic. It causes all of the assumptions, the beliefs that you've been making, why you'll never get into a crisis to crash. Not just one or two of your whole belief system. Very few people can survive that. So one of the big beliefs that we know Silicon Valley has, they're so big and powerful, and the money is so, that we have enough power and clout to withstand any government intervention. Yeah, you keep believing that, because that will be the death deal. Not now, not right away, but I've seen it happen again and again. All the things you're assuming, why you will not get into a crisis, become the bane, become the downfall. So therefore, the internal assassin team is not a luxury. None of it's a luxury. That's the kind of work I deal with. It's not pleasant, but it's like being a medical doctor. You got to go in and face the god-awful reality and do the best you can.
Great, great. Just
grow up. Face reality. And reality ain't all fun and games and pleasant and not just all positive thing. Doesn't mean it's a downer, because here's the thing that happens. Over the years, my colleagues and I, PhD students, have done studies of organizations that are crisis prepared. And I want you to hear what happens. Only 15-20% at best. The organizations that are prepared for crises, experience fewer crises, significantly more profitable, recover faster from a crisis than those who are unprepared. So it's not only the right ethical thing to do, but it's good for business.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And yet, if you talk to reactive organizations, it doesn't get through. The proactive organizations have a different culture. Because while they're doing crisis management, they're picking up problems before they're too big to fix. And those are the kind of organizations from whom I've learned and are my model. And what they do, they use that attitude to run the whole business. So they're picking up on all kinds of issues. And they're listening to people down at the bowels of the organization to bring them news that they don't want to hear. That's what the good organization, tell me what I don't want to hear. And you don't get dinged for doing that. And that means you set up the kind of culture where you have meetings time to time where you invite all the workers across up and down the hierarchy and the top of the organization says, tell me what I don't want to hear, but what I need to hear. And what do we need to fix? It takes a lot of guts to do that. It takes a lot of strength of character. But if we didn't have any organization to do it, then it would be impossible. But I've seen the ones can do it. That's the great. Best response I can
wonderful,
give you.
Wonderful. One more big concept I want to throw at okay. you and also at the audience. I heard a term the other day which I thought I had to really think about. I thought, that's an interesting term. It was called the customerization of citizenship. And what they were getting at is there were certain rights I should have as a citizen. For example, access to, we think, health care or clean water. But no, these should be sold to you as a customer, provided you have the income to pay for it. Now, I thought, this is a very interesting concept. And it appears that in some of the, I guess, boldness with which some of the technology companies are pursuing, they may be crossing or coming pretty close to this line of trying to privatize services that are better provided to us as a citizen, as opposed to me paying for it. So here's an example that really hit me pretty hard. How many of you think you can apply for a job without access to the internet? You can't do it.
Can't do it.
So is access to the internet something you should pay for as a customer or something you should have access to as a citizen? So.
Well, as you were talking, let me give a bit of personal history because I grew up with a very different attitude. I was born and raised in San Francisco, grew up in a chronically poor family. And at an early age, it popped in my mind, I didn't want to live like my parents. I was good at school. I loved school. And I took to school like you wouldn't believe. Now, I grew up in an era when I went to Berkeley that was essentially free. I got a free education, started as a freshman paying $56 a semester with a PhD, $200, unheard of. And I got government loans for room and board that were all forgiven in 6 years because I was a professor. You think I view government as the enemy? Yeah, it needs to be improved. I have a different tack, and I also focus on responsibilities. I view it as a responsibility to pay taxes. I view it as a responsibility to think of the common greater good. Yeah, there are rights. And, you know, I was reminded that Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz were having a town hall talking about what rights there were in healthcare and everything. And Ted Cruz said something incredible to me that essentially the only rights we have as citizens were those that were granted us 200 years of the founding of the Republic. And really, no new rights ever came into being like healthcare. And I wish that Bernie Sanders had said that and say, wait a second, their rights are not fixed. What Bernie has done, and declaring my spots, that he's gone into West Virginia, red states, And he's talked with people who voted for Trump, Donald Trump. And he's listened respectfully, didn't push back. And after he showed he could listen respectfully, then he pushed back a bit. And he's got, you know, he changed the minds of some. They didn't change everybody's mind. But I grew up in a different era. So I also look at what are the responsibilities. And I view paying taxes as a fundamental responsibility. I want other kids to have the opportunities that I had. And when I started Berkeley, 1956, so you can take a guess how old I am anyway, the state of California provided 60% of the budget for UC Berkeley and the Berkeley system. You know what it's down to now? 16%. That's a major financial calamity. Major. So no wonder they have to go out and get, you know, students that, you know, come from other states where they can charge a hefty and do research and all the rest of that. It takes away from teaching. I was primarily a teacher, writer, but one of the things I always loved was teaching, because without the give and take, you can't develop your ideas. You can't do it in isolation. So I view responsibility as key. Not that I'm perfect by any means, but I grew up in a different era. So rights and responsibilities are conjoined. You can't talk about one without the other.
Okay, great. This is my last question, so I want you to get your questions in mind, and you can line up behind the mic, and my colleague Bo is going to organize you on the Q&A, so feel free to come up with your questions as well. So here's the last concept I want to throw at you. Unintended consequences or bad side effects. I'm familiar with the concept of cause and effect, that if there was a cause. And so this notion that there are unintended consequences to me seems to be some kind of sleight of hand value judgment to allow people to not deal with the consequences of their actions. So are there really such things as unintended consequences?
Well, yeah, there are, because we're not all perfect and can foresee what happens in anything we do. But let me up the ante. I not just work in crisis management, but I work in complex, messy system. Let me just give you a little background on it. When I went to Berkeley, there was a guy in the architecture department, Horst Riddle, who pioneered the concept of wicked problems. A wicked problem was a problem that couldn't be defined solely by any discipline. No profession or discipline had a monopoly how to define a problem. And he talked about wicked versus tame problem. Tame problem is like an exercise. X plus C equals 11 fine X. That's not a problem. It's an exercise. Only one. The problem's already formulated, and there's only one right answer. That's not the world in which we live. Wicked problems are problems for which nobody has the definitive formulation. There may not even be a solution. If there is a solution, it may cause worse problems than the original problem. Okay, hold that aside. Then another one of my philosophical mentors was a guy by the name of Russ Acuff at Penn, student, one of my prime mentors. And Russ Acuff appropriated the word mess to stand for a whole system problem so interconnected, couldn't take any problem out of the mess without distorting irreparably both the problem and the mess. Okay, folks, here's the new world in which we live, wicked messes. We don't live in the world of simple exercise, and yet who's giving us? Now, when you deal with wicked messes, all you get are heuristic rules of thumb, because only algorithms apply to exercise. You don't get that. So let me give you an example. If you talk about ISIS in international relations, here's one of the prime heuristics that drives people crazy or looking for cause and effect. And here's the prime heuristic. Pick the least bad of all possible options. You don't get perfect options. Pick the least bad of all the bad options in dealing with a mess. Now, what I'd like to see if I could reorganize universities is that every department would deal with the wicked messes, whether it's homelessness or income inequality or whatever, because that's what we're dealing with. But our education is not kept up with reality. So back of crisis management, back of technology, and all, is really the world of wicked messes. And that's where I spend the majority of my time thinking about what kind of, for example, one of the prime heuristics is that in a mess, the two most improbable things will connect up to cause a crisis. And those are the things you want to look at, whether the internal assassin team, whatever. Now, people can be educated, trained to do that. It's not easy. But I've seen enough young students who can be motivated. They're not getting this. Not easy. But welcome to the new world. Welcome to reality. But you know what's happened? I grew up in the world of exercises, where things are defined precisely, the definition of the problem doesn't change. Let me give you a metaphor of what we're dealing with. If you go back to the 16th, 17th century, where the great mathematical minds formulated the rules of probability, they were dealing with simple games of chance, like you had a deck of 52 cards, what's the probability of drawing an ace? Well, you got four ways you can draw an ace out of 52, so it's 1 over 13. You know the world we're dealing with? We're dealing with a deck of cards that isn't fixed. So every time the number of cards change and the face values of the cards are changing, you tell me how you do risk management and risk analysis with a deck of cards that's changing. Well, you got to deal with messes. You got to have a different kind of education. It's hard. I find it exciting. Does it often cause me, sleepless nights? You're darn right it does. But it keeps me from getting bored, I'll tell you that. And what I know in my gut, that's the reality in which we're dealing. ISIS is one of the craziest messes, but they're all crazy. North Korea, all of them. And to think we're going to deal with them cause-effect, uh-uh. And psychology and sociology, they're all wrapped up in it, right? Psychology of the leader, our leader, whatever it is. That means we need to educate people that are not the prisoner of any single discipline. I'll give you my one-liner, which will probably alienate me even further, but it's how I felt about engineering. I absolutely loved engineering when I went to school, but I ended up not liking engineers. They were too narrow, too linear. And I feel the same thing now about academics. We've got to cross over. The disciplines we have were largely formulated 16th, 17th century. You know what the origin of the word academic discipline is? Most academics don't like it. In the time of Descartes, disciplines came to be because soldiers marked, quote, indiscipline. And that word was taken over to academic disciplines, which our good old liberal academics don't. We're not in the world of disciplines anymore. Now our disciplinary approaches to problems. The problems we have defy that. Income inequality, homelessness, all of them defy being squozed into that kind of stuff. Anyway, I've ranted and raved enough, so please tell me what's on your mind. Okay. Yes, sir.
Just in transition, please join me in thanking Gerald and Ian for sharing their thoughts on dangers of a digitized world. We would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. We now open the floor for questions. Please keep your questions short and concise, and please keep them questions. And please come up to the mic with any questions that you have.
This is more of a request for comment from Ian about as technology dominates and is interconnecting different systems, banking systems, communication systems and all that, the implications from a crisis management standpoint for terrorism in those systems, for spontaneous problems in the systems. Do you have any thoughts about that you could share?
Well, when I was at USC, I was fortunate enough to be a member of the USC Crisis Committee, and the provost was on board. And we were able to send out a questionnaire to the provost of other universities, what they were doing to combat various crises in colleges and universities. And the story I have to tell you, as bad as corporations are, colleges and universities are even worse in combating crises because, again, they were burdened with all these narrow academic disciplines. So the professors in the disciplines couldn't think beyond their own narrow discipline. Now, the provost's job was to do that, because when you look at all the businesses that a university, any university like USC, you want to hear the bit, they're in the sports business, the entertainment business, the hotel business. Oh, yeah, the education business, too. But very few people were thinking about across all the businesses of a complex institution. And for me, that's just second nature because I'm one of the developers of the field of crisis management, and I work, which, but unfortunately, Cedric, the research has been pretty constant, and only 15-20% at best of all organizations are proactive, have the guts, whatever it is, to think about the stuff. Yeah, it's unpleasant. But again, the organizations that do it are more profitable. So again, not only the right thing to do, but it's good for the bottom line. And I wish I could just get the message out. But what we're confronting, like all things, is corporate culture, the mindset. And it's not rational. I mean, I have to say it's like the people who voted for Donald Trump. They have to be faced with the fact that 24 million people are going to be without insurance, because they can give all the arguments in the world, but those don't get through unless you're faced with a dire reality. I hate to say that, you know, particularly as a social scientist, devoted my whole life to argumentation, but I have to face that reality. Yes, ma'am.
So kind of going back to technology, you mentioned regulation and kind of trying to monitor this a little bit better and think about the risks moving forward. Can you point to any examples in the past where companies realize their technology has had negative social impact and has self-corrected, or some other good examples that we could potentially learn from moving forward?
That's a good question, and I'm scrambling to think of, because I haven't dealt with technology companies per se. In fact, let me give you a little background on the crisis management center that I ran. Early on, I was advised, oh, just pick one industry, become an expert in that, and I realized that would not be systemic. So we had companies across virtually every industry, and they all used technology. We had from, you know, aviation, commercial aviation, technology, you know, consumer products, whatever it is. And what we began to find, what we found, it was not the industry. No, I'll tell you what we found. You don't have to go in and tell the chemical industry to prepare for fires and explosions, because that's normal business, happens every day. What you have to go in and tell them and say, have you thought about human-caused crises, like PR crises, that they deem irrational? So you're always picking up the shadow side, no matter what the industry. And again, it's only found 15 to 20%, no matter what the industry, were able to think expansively, systemically. So again, I keep saying the same message again and again. What can we do to get people to think more? The irony, we're in a system of systems world. Ain't going away. It's getting more complex. And we can't go back to the old ways of thinking because it's not adequate. In fact, it makes it worse. Okay? That's why, you know, technology brings along with it a whole set of crises, not only opportunities and benefits. So I can't say that. In fact, let me tell you what I did is that the only companies that I will mention by name are those that are in the news like VW or Facebook for good reason. Because I can't mention the good companies with which I work because I don't want to wave the flag. And I've done that over the years. So unfortunately, the companies that make the news are the companies that are screwed up. And I'm very critical of Facebook. It ain't going away. I know that. And kids are attracted to it. I understand that. But don't tell me we couldn't have done a better job of fake news and all the rest of that. I contend that we could. Anyway, that's the best response that I can give to your good question. Ian.
Hi, Ian.
Ian.
Yeah. So you discussed some of the successful current CEOs in the Valley with their ability to create technology but not necessarily be able to manage it. And it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like the solution to this is having a team of consisting of multiple disciplines involved with the development of that technology. So I guess my question for you is, how do you empower organizations across the board to have multiple disciplines on the managing team? And do you think that comes from, you know, a sustainable, you know, incentivizing these organizations to do that themselves? Or is it going to come from a public backlash at some point?
Well, I think it's come from all of the above. But let me give you a model that many of you, I'm sure, have heard of. That is really the model. It's called IDEO. How many of you have heard of IDEO? Very creative organization. And one of the things projects I remember from IDEO, they have anthropologists and sociologists, psychologists. So they go into supermarkets and they study how people looked at, how used shopping carts. So they reinvented the shopping cart and put a little thing on a little computer on the shopping cart that would alert you where you're on the aisle and how much things would cost. It's a model. It's not easy. I'm not saying all disciplines have to be there, but one thing I know in the running of a company, you need obviously to have the technologists who invented the technology and know it in depth. That's a given. But you also need to have people who know about people and studied management and talked about how you motivate people and the kind of knowledge that they need. And you have to get the technologists and the people in the same room to say, we're going to have a hard conversation. It's not going to be pleasant and fun, but we're going to have to look at the cross impacts of this stuff. You want to do this? Okay, let's look at the downside. Because here's one of the things that it's the hardest for anybody to do. I almost forgot this. The hardest task facing human beings throughout their lives is to look how their prized positives can turn into a negative. Who wants to contemplate that? Well, if you're a medical doctor, you damn well better do that, right? Before you undertake the operation. Well, that has to be extended to how we run these companies. So it has to be somebody in the company who says, wait a second, we have to take an honest look at reality here. Now, here's the good news. I contend if you do that, you'll be in a stronger competitive position than the companies that don't do that, because I've seen that. And that's the selling point. So not just the backlash, but the positive selling, because you need both the carrot and the stick, okay? And all I can do is what I do, and obviously I believe in it passionately or I wouldn't keep doing it. And I know it's important because technology ain't going away, right, guys? No way. And it's made our lives incomparably better. But it also brings along a whole host of crises, which if we don't attend to, become our downfall.
So I think you mentioned Volkswagen, but I'm not sure whether you did or not. But so
yes,
my
I did.
Question,
yeah.
So my question has to do specifically with Volkswagen.
Okay.
So the culture of Volkswagen comes clearly from the top, like all organizations, doesn't come from the bottom. So we have a situation with Volkswagen where they manipulated the software on purpose to pass the test. And the person who was actually in charge of the software engineering ended up admitting, finally, that he did that and ended up with many fines and probably in jail, et cetera. We're talking about corporate culture. So we're talking about the organization who is asking the people inside the organization to make algorithms, to make systems that will provide them more money or to game the system or something. So how does that stop? And how do we get people inside the organization, for example, that man who was in charge of the software engineering, to have enough strength, ethics, to say, maybe I don't want to do this. Maybe this is not a good thing. How do we get people to do that kind of thing?
Well, when I was in a business school, I was in a business school before corporate culture became a hot topic and then as it developed. And one of the things we learned about corporate culture, it's akin to the personality of an organization. In a lot of organizations, you could fire everybody and hire a new set of people, and they'll turn out and act like the old set of people unless you change the corporate culture. And the corporate culture is the unwritten rules of how you dress, what you say, and how you get along with people. Because, see, I don't know all of Volkswagen, how that corporate culture, because I doubt that anybody, they could have said, let's that's explicitly fiddle, but enough messages were sent coded or uncoded. Now, you know how Volkswagen was picked up? Some second-tier university, I hate to say that, West Virginia University, because my wife and I, we have a family farm that was down in West Virginia. West Virginia University had an automotive lab that they would test cars to see whether they were living up to their claim, emissions and everything, and they picked up the discrepancy. So VW, costing, by the way, projected $11 billion bucks. That's a lot to bet the company. And they were betting the whole company on the fact that this wouldn't come to light. That's a hell of a bet. I mean, but that's what corporate culture does. And it's only when, I mean, you got to fire the CEO and it's criminal, but it's one of the biggest industries in Germany. So you're talking about not just a crisis for the particular company, and now you're talking about Porsche and what are the other companies affiliated with VW, Audi. But you're talking about a company that is integral to a country. Because one of the things that we have learned about crises, they don't stay fixed. There's no such thing as a single crisis. Each crisis becomes a chain reaction. So it starts as...
How do you get that software engineer to push back?
Well, that's... that you. Unless he or she is explicitly given, like I told you, assembling people, tell me what I don't want to know, what I don't want to hear. Unless that's part of the culture, he or she can't do it. They won't do it. Or like the Google guy who quit because he couldn't get them to back off from making apps that were highly addictive to kids. Now, I hate to say that because look, we know what the fate is of most whistleblowers. It's not pretty. They get fired. They're piranhas. They don't get hired in the industry again. And yeah, there's some protection. But here's what I'm hoping is that we get enough understanding to say that's not business as usual anymore. We can't. In fact, that was one of the books that I had with Josie Bad, Business Not As Usual. But let me tell you a little story. I think, God, I'm going to block on the Elie Wiesel, Holocaust survivor, tells his story. It's one of my favorite. It's a story about an old man who was outside Sodom and Gomorrah, and he was on a soapbox like I am for his whole life, and a little boy comes up and said, you know, you've been preaching against this licentiousness for years, and nothing's changed. The old man looks at the kid and says, you're right. I start out preaching to hope to change them. Now I'm preaching so they won't change me. Can't give up the fight. I refuse to give up the fight. But we're fighting against cultures. Now, thank God there are a few cultures which are models that show it can be. But it's got to be orchestrated. It doesn't just happen. They're kept alive to start by a founder and, you know, hiring the right set of people. And it becomes the culture. But then it's got to be kept alive by the successors. And one of the hardest things to do is to keep the good culture alive is people who come after the founder. But it can be done. Ain't easy. But tell me what's good that is easy. It's a challenge.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
I was wondering, you'd mentioned self-driving cars earlier.
Right.
And I think in the United States, a lot of times we see driving our cars as a piece of freedom and liberty.
Right.
And what's your point of view on the rights and responsibilities and the power of the people who give up driving and go to self-driving cars?
I'm mixed in self-driving cars. I mean, I don't. The technology is still out, but I'll tell you one thing: since I've been back in the Bay Area 11 years, I've seen the decrease in driving skills are incredible. People don't use turn signals. It's you know the bad driving is people speeding with hyped up cars is amazing, and I keep asking when will driver education come back. One I didn't mention. It's not just VW. I could have also mentioned Wells Fargo as a case in of culture. How was the culture that you could set up millions of unauthorized accounts and then bill people for credit card? Well, obviously, I'll tell you.
Those people stopped. They continued to do the same thing because that's what they were supposed to do.
Yeah.
So we're all robots.
a lot of robotic. You know, some people wake up from being robots, but it's hard. It ain't easy. It's hard to be a human being, isn't it? It's not easy. It's not programmed in from the beginning. But I believe it can be done. I'm here. I wouldn't. You know, one of my mottos is don't let the bastards grind you down. Or maybe I shouldn't say that word. Don't let them grind you down. Don't give in. It's a fight, but it's a good fight. It's worth fighting for.
Do you have any other questions from the audience?
I appreciated your talk. I want to ask something a little more provocative, maybe. So what do you think is a larger problem, the lack of humanist view of technology leaders or the lack of general awareness on the part of the consumer?
I'd say it's all of the above. I mean, what I would add is the lack of awareness at every step in the chain of technologists, of consumers, teachers, parents. It's systemic. It's easy to just put the blame on technologists, and I've been largely doing that today and aware of that. But it is more shared. And again, what I don't know what the mechanism are. I'm just sounding the alarm. But I know that I'm not the only one talking about the dangers of technology. I mean, it's all around us. And it ain't going away. I know that. And that would be foolish to think that it is. But I'm calling for the better management. And the better management is technologists and people who've studied corporate culture and how to run humane organizations. And it's humanists. When in my book, I have a chapter on the technological mindset, which is up here. But it's followed by a humanistic mindset that says, how do we run technology humanistically? How do we manage it humanistically? So, for example, there's no such thing as technology without a set of social systems to nurture it and sustain it. That's a fallacy. That's a fantasy. But then it's got to be the kind that does sustain it. Because there's nothing that's done without human beings and social institutions. And they got to work in bed. But I know we've been talking about that. Now, one thing I would say is this. Our ethics is as well developed as it's going to be. That's not the problem. The problem is that of implementation. The philosophical school in which I grew up, school, was pragmatism. I'll give you pragmatism's definition of truth, which has always guided me. Truth is that which makes an ethical difference in the quality of your life. So in pragmatism, truth, epistemology, ethics, and aesthetic quality are all joined. They're inseparable. But that little word makes is critical. We don't have truth in pragmatism till we begin to make an ethical difference. Not just talking about it, not just writing about it. So I hope enough people are here who are empowered and reach enough companies to make a difference. Write in, that they go out and they make. Because that little word makes is all critical. Let me give you the opening pages of the masterpiece of William James, my hero, Pragmatism. And let me tell you what William James said. It's chilling beyond belief, but it's a wake-up call. William James starts his masterpiece with a headline pulled from the Boston Herald of a man who was too infirm to work for a couple of years out of work. He finally gets a job. He goes out and works as a day laborer, but he's unable to complete it. He comes home depressed, kills his wife and his three children, kills himself. And William James asks, what does philosophy have to say about this? If it has nothing to say, it has nothing to say. So for William James, the problems of living were the stuff of philosophy, not some abstract stuff about, you know, rationalism and arguments. Yeah, that's necessary. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about designing organizations that are more ethical and more humane. And that's the task facing us, and that's what we need to be committed to every second, every hour of our lives.
Thank you again to our speaker for the evening. And to our listening audience, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is now adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. I appreciate the questions and comments.